Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our new online entertainment editor, Emily Murray. Hello, Emily.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, well, thank you for coming. I hope you'll be here a lot.
Yeah, we
already spend a lot of time gassing about films, so we might as well do it with all of the people that are listening here. So this week we're talking to Ari Aster about his latest mind melder, Beau is Afraid, and we'll be reviewing that as well as Judy Blume's coming of age, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, and the bombastic car actioner, Fast X. But before we get onto that, what have you been watching this week, Emily? Where have you been to? What have you been seeing?
It's been a really busy week so far, actually. We went to Little Mermaid together, didn't we, Jane?
We went to the UK premiere.
Yeah. The UK premiere, very fancy. It was like a blue beachy carpet, I think. Very beautiful. I cried in Little Mermaid. Maybe I just have a soft touch, but it did make me cry. So that was quite an emotional screening. It's something that's very close to my heart. I love the original. I used to have like an Ariel Barbie growing up, and I'd always put her in a bath. And my mum would be like, you shouldn't put your Barbies in a bath. I'd be like, but she belongs in the sea. She belongs in the water.
But her hair got absolutely knackers doing that, didn't
it? Yeah, I don't think she lasted pretty long. So we went to Little Mermaid. I also saw The Flash yesterday, went to an early screening, which is out next month. And I was pretty excited because Michael Keaton's back as Batman. I know you've seen it as well.
Yeah. We're not allowed to say, are we, yet? But we are allowed to say sentiment, i.e. yay or nay. Was it
this
a yay
true.
Or a nay?
Mostly a yay. Mostly for me.
Mixed feelings.
Yes. I was pretty hyped. I don't think it lived up to my hype, but I still had a really fun time, which is good.
Yes, it is. And who have you been interviewing this week?
Oh, who have I been interviewing this week? I haven't done any interviews yet this week, but I did have a very unique experience in interviewing the Muppets recently, which I've never done before, which was very fun, but interesting in a sense that, well, yeah, the Muppets are chaos, so I didn't really know what to expect from them. It was really fun, though.
Who did you interview? It's Animal and...
So Animal and Floyd Pepper, because they have a new Disney Plus show called Muppets Mayhem, which is following the Muppets house band as they record their very first album. They've been together since 1975, never recorded an album. So Animal, I wasn't sure what to ask Animal because he's not exactly a talker, is he?
No.
But he gave me some great answers, as did Floyd Pepper. So it was a really fun chat. I am convinced, though, that they like Googled me before. Because I had to send my questions over in advance, so, you know, like, they can be improved, the Muppets can prepare. And then one of my questions was, like, what band would they like to collaborate with in the future? Their answer was U2, which is, like, my favourite band. Because even though I'm 28 years old, I just love U2. It's my dad's favourite band, I think that's why. And I think that's just a bit of a spooky coincidence, right?
Well, maybe they're just musically so attuned to people that they can read this off you. Read you like a book, because they're just such musical superstars. But quite diva-ish to ask for the questions beforehand.
I know, that's what I thought. And then I wasn't allowed to ask one as well. They were like, oh, that's cheeky. That's a cheeky spoiler one. Animal called me naughty.
He can talk.
Yeah, I know, exactly. In one of my friend's interviews, he decided to run off camera to go grab a stapler for his dinner. So pretty chaotic.
I mean, who hasn't had that happen during an interview with someone, really? Anyway,
exactly.
On that note, shall we get on something that is completely different? Or is it? Maybe it isn't really from The Muppets. It's this. It's time to get weird with Ari Aster's latest.
I am so sorry for what your daddy passed down to you. But I wanted a child. The greatest gift of my life.
I'm visiting my mother tomorrow.
Hi, Carrot. It's Mom. I'm just calling to say that I'm so, so, so excited to see you tomorrow. You're my angel, and I love you. Okay. I love you. Okay, bye, sweetie. I love you.
Are you at the airport?
I'm on my way. It's not safe, is it? What do you think I should do?
I'm sure you'll do the right thing, sweetheart.
Help!
Okay, so this is from the filmmaker who screwed you up with Hereditary and Midsommar. It's Ari Aster's latest, and it tracks Joaquin Phoenix's sad sack, Beau, as he attempts to visit his controlling mother. Before Emily and I discuss the film, let's hear what Aster had to say about the project when he sat down with our other Emily, Emily Garbutt, earlier this week.
So you wrote the script for Beau is Afraid over a decade ago, I read. So does that predate your previous movies, Hereditary and Midsommar?
The first, I guess, draft of this that I wrote was long before I wrote Hereditary or Midsommar, but it wasn't the first thing I had written. It was one of many scripts that I tried to get it made as a feature and couldn't. And then when I was finished with Midsommar, I thought, well, maybe it would be time to dust that one off and see how it's feeling, because I remembered having so much fun writing it. And it was just a world that I always wanted to sort of realize. And so I went back to it. And it still made me laugh, and you know, but I had new ideas. There were things that didn't work for me anymore, or things that I wanted to sort of grow or deepen. And so I went back to writing, to, I guess, polishing it. But it was really just a rewrite, and it was good timing because it was lockdown, and so I had the time to just sort of swim around in it. The film is a picaresque. That's a tradition that almost demands that the work be spacious,
sure.
and be something that you can kind of roam around in and explore. And I think it was just the right project at the right time.
I also noticed while watching it that, you know, we sort of see a bit more of the outside world than we do in your other two films, sort of like Beau walking around, although it's, you know, his sort of own nightmarish version of the world. Is that something that you think we'll see more of in your film, sort of your vision of the real world, so to speak? Or do you prefer those more sort of claustrophobic, as I said, like rooted stories that we've seen with Hereditary and Midsommar?
Well, I think there's a claustrophobia here too. Mm. It's hard to say, right? Because it's not so self-conscious as that. You know, that this just is the world of Beau is Afraid, right? It's possessed of maybe more of a nightmare logic. It's a comedy, and it never really stops being a comedy. There is like a sustained joke happening here, you know, especially like the first part of the film, you know, kind of functions as like a gag machine, or like, you know, almost like a Rube Goldberg machine of like incidents that just like snowball. I can say that the process of making this film and writing it was like a very joyful one, and I really had fun making this, which makes me want to do something like this again. It'll never be, this is the world of Beau is Afraid. So like that's that.
Yeah.
There's a lot of me in this film. And I would say that more than anything I've made, like this kind of allowed me to be just kind of free and unrestrained.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of like untethered nightmare logic also allowed me to include things that other films, you know, might not be able to hold. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that I'll find my way back to something like this. But yeah, every film kind of, I mean, every story, it imposes different like parameters, right? And so you just have to be sensible as to what those are.
Mm. Yeah, so you spoke about the comedy in the film there, and I think, you know, Joaquin Phoenix is fantastic as Beau, and he's got great comic timing, and he really brings through the comedy in the script. So was he an actor that you sort of always had in mind for the role, or, you know, how did his casting come about?
I mean, he's just an actor that I've always wanted to work with. And so he made sense for this. Like, he made immediate sense for this. And so the idea was, okay, well, let's offer it to Joaquin. And then when he turns it down, let's figure out who we go to next. But, you know, happily, he took to the script and we started talking. And that turned into sort of a courtship, where I think he was feeling me out and feeling out the project. And I think that has less to do with even the nature of the film itself than just, you know, the fact that he commits himself, you know, body and soul to whatever he does. So he really takes a long time to decide whether he can do that, because he's never going to do anything half-heartedly.
Mm-hmm.
But I've wanted to work with him since, for a long time. I think I've dreamed of working with him since I first saw like To Die For. When I was thinking about this film, I was thinking a lot about his performance in I'm Still Here. Not only because I think it's one of the great comic performances, but because what he does with his name in that film struck me as kind of a suicidal gesture, but like kind of a heroic one. Like it really, or rather it felt like the gesture of like a true artist, and one without any vanity at all. I mean, yeah, if anything, there's like some psychosis there. I can say that he's a much more like technical actor than I even imagined. You see his performances, and they're so personal and they're so vulnerable. Speaking for myself, I imagined that they were like almost totally spontaneous, and that he was just kind of following like whims, right? And that's not at all what he does. he's incredibly intentional and makes very clear decisions and can really stay on a track. I mean, even just his feeling for continuity is like incredible.
I think it's fair to say as well that the film's sort of dividing opinions. So is that almost like satisfying as a filmmaker that people are getting such different things out of this thing that you've made?
I knew this film would be divisive. And it's a film of extremes. And it's also, you know, I think it's a film that's really playing with structure in a way that might even feel to people counterintuitive. But for me, it felt like totally intuitive. Mm-hmm. But it's also the structure of a picaresque. You know, it's a film that kind of changes shape. And there are like arguably four acts. But you could argue that there are six. If I could give any sort of disclaimer to anybody going into the film, I would say something along the lines of the film is sort of a shape-shifting beast in that the more open you are to it, probably the better. It's a film that I kind of felt my way through making it, and I think the best way to watch it is to feel your way through it.
Emily, this is a very difficult one to sort of pass and sort of break down and do a logline, but have a go. What is this about?
What is Beau Is Afraid about? Well, I think we can sum it up best as what Ari Aster described it as, which is a 3-hour long nightmare comedy. And it follows Joaquin Phoenix's pretty anxious fellow, Beau, as he goes on a very long journey to basically his mum's house. He receives some news about his mum. He wants to go check in on his mum. And on that journey, he has some very strange experiences, yeah. I think is how we can best sum it up. This film baffled me. I don't know if it baffled you, Jane.
I mean, I thought I knew what was going on and I thought I had a grasp of it, but it's incredibly slippery, isn't it? And,
You
know, it is about monstrous controlling mothers. It is about parents and children. It is about guilt. It's about anxiety, about people's anxiety of living in modern times. There's so much going on. And it's non-linear in a way. It's also sort of like an odyssey. There's live action, there's animation, there's like complete flights of fantasy of things that are lurking in attics. There's an absolute obsession with balls and ball sacks.
A big obsession, yeah.
Big obsession. So it's like, what is this about? And maybe that's the point, that each to their own and you imprint on it what you take away from it. I found that very difficult to do that myself. I don't know about you.
It's a tough watch. I came out of it, and I don't know if you had this, but like all the critics sort of mingle after, talk about it. And some people hated this film, like really detested it. I actually I was about to say enjoy. I think enjoy is actually the wrong choice of word there. I think I liked it because I couldn't take my eyes off the screen. But when somebody asked me what I thought it was about, I have no idea, because I think the issue is there's too much going on. Mm. I think there's way too much going on. I think within the film itself, there's some great moments, such as the first, I think, hour chunk, which is mostly just capturing the anxiety.
Yes.
As we see Joaquin Phoenix, are you battling the people on the street and trying to get to his flat. I thought it did such a great job of just capturing just sheer anxiety and the everyday battle of living with anxiety. You know, he loses his keys and just how those like things just impact his brain. I thought that was done really well. And I think Joaquin Phoenix is fantastic. It's mostly just all him, isn't it? Like he's rare, especially in the first hour, it's just him on the phone or just, you know, standing around. And There's a lot of scenes where he is just simply standing and he's just got this lost look in his eyes and he's shaken. And I found that really, really effective. But I think it started to lose me in the forest, like halfway through when we got to the forest. And that's when I started to really feel the length, really just lose track of where is this going. And I think it claws it back towards the end with the mum stuff, which comes full circle. But I'm just really baffled by this one. I really don't know what to make of it. I know I liked it in a sense that I could, like, I was enraptured by it, but I can't say I never want to see this again.
same. It was more of a sort of ordeal for me to watch this. It's 3 hours long. I don't think we mentioned that. It's 3 hours long.
It's so
and some
long.
Films you are happily going along with, and this one was not. I was looking at my watch, like, how much more of this is there?
Yeah, I tried to avoid that.
And I agree with you. Like, I thought it was incredibly brilliant, the beginning, which is this, he lives in this awful apartment that is just, there's noise, there's terrible neighbors, there's
the notes, the scene where he keeps getting notes, oh, so stressful.
The awful, like, people on the street that are just like aggressive. There's a weird stabby man that stabs with no reasoning, which is like my ultimate fear, that sort of idea of somebody that you can't predict. You could just be going about your life and that somebody who just decides to do that just affects everybody's lives by doing that, and there's nothing you can do to stop it.
Yeah,
that sort of lack of control. The losing of your keys, the missing of a flight. I mean, I find going to the airport to catch a flight quite stressful at the best of times.
Yes,
this taps into that, like home invasion anxiety, people pooing in your house anxiety. Not that that's anxiety of mine, but I mean, all
going
of these
to the
things.
Till, getting your car rejected. Like the first hour is amazing.
It's like really watching Uncut Gems right up. It's so, my jaw hurts from clenching watching that first segment. And then there's an accident and it switches to another sort of scenario, which starts to come even more weirder. And then, as you say, goes for a walk in the forest. And there's this whole section that doesn't appear to have much to do with anything that's gone before or a great deal to what goes after. And then there's this moment where there's a giant, massive penis and balls monster in an attic.
No idea.
And at that point, I give up. And I wondered, is this actually the point that life and anxieties and all of the things that we worry about are just things that you can't get a handle on, are sort of slippery ideas, and you can't sort life and you can't order it. It is just random. It is weird. And that's, and we should just accept it. Is that the point?
Maybe. I do like the fact that it is quite open, though. It feels very free-flowing from Ari Aster. I am slightly concerned it's a bit too free-flowing, but he's just been given permission to sort of just go full out. I think it definitely could have been tighter, especially since I absolutely adore Hereditary and Midsommar, and I think this film couldn't be more different from those two movies. I mean, there's still that sense of dread, but it's a different kind of sense of dread. I think the sequence you're on about, which is completely separate, which is it's the theatre one, right? It's what you're referring to. I did love the use of animation. It was so beautiful, like, to look at, but I have no idea how that ties to any of the rest of the story at all.
No.
Like, not a clue. And so I think it claws it back at the end when he confronts his mum, and there's that's quite an emotional moment. But ebbs and flows for me, ebbs and flows.
Yeah. It reminded me of Bardo, the Inarritu film
that came out at
Venice. The sort of idea that these auteurs are given a load of money and off you go, and you can do anything you want. It's A24. They're like, please, just do what you want, which is great. But sometimes maybe reining in is something that does need to happen.
I think so. It's self-indulgent.
It feels like sort of masturbatory cinema to me. It is, and in the case of this, with the amount of ball sacks and penises, it literally is. There is a thing about ejaculation that is a very big segment as well, and a concern about what would happen if you ejaculate, and then that happens. There is a lot of spunk going on this film, and I feel like that's artistically as well as physically. So by the end of it, it had worn my patience thin, and I had gone from liking it to just being irritated by it.
I did on the whole like it. I think I admire quite a lot of it. I just wish the first hour is so good. I could have just done with like more of that. I feel like it's two separate projects in a way. Like he's sort of melded together, because you got the mummy issues one and then you got the anxiety one. And I feel like it just could have been two separate films maybe. But Joaquin Phoenix, as ever.
Astonishing.
Fantastic.
Yes.
Fantastic.
Fully commits, and you know, like, he is wearing this giant ball sack, so look for that swinging about as he slops into baths and whatnot. Yeah, fully commits. You can't say that it's not a really engaging performance from him. It is. Will it do well awardsy?
I don't think so. I think it's too strange. And like, in terms of box office as well, like, I actually don't know if I could recommend this film to anyone because it's so weird and so divisive. I couldn't see, like, me saying to someone, if you want to go see a film this weekend, go see Bo is Afraid, because like, I have no idea how they will react to it, because it is.
And also, somebody could be
reaction.
Really offended, like, why would you think that was for me?
Yeah, exactly.
What are you saying about my mother or my ball sack?
You saying you enjoy looking at giant penis monsters? Yeah, I literally can't even put into words how weird this movie is. I'm just so baffled by it. And I was like reading online last night, like trying to get my head around all the metaphors, but I feel like there's just no consensus at all, which is good, like, that it is so open, but maybe too open.
It's a Rorschach test, where basically you see whatever you want to see. And in that respect, as all great art is, it's a wonderful thing. And if you want to engage with that and see what it brings out of you, then maybe that's the way forward. And also, if you're an Ari Aster fan, then you probably want to see this just to see this left turn that he's taken. Well, not so much of this evolution that he's gone through. And it'd be really interesting to see what he does next after
that. That's what I was thinking. I hope he gets reined in a bit more maybe for next one. I know some people like adore this film. So people obviously are relating to it, but I'm just a bit like, come on, Ari, let's get back on track. And for me, Hereditary and Midsommar were like 5-star classics. I struggled with. It is a challenge to watch. It's very challenging. It does feel like an exam in a way. Like, will you pass the Beau's Afraid test?
Yes.
Or be able to sit through it?
Yeah, indeed. So if you fancy trying out the Beau's Afraid test, it is out in cinemas this Friday. Let us know what you think, because honestly, we don't know. Okay, let's move on then from one mummy to another then. It's this.
Are you Zaragod?
It's me, Margaret.
I'm here to speak to you today about your changing bodies.
The blood is released through the vagina.
Please, just do this one thing for me.
Let me just be normal and regular like everybody else. Just please, 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 please. What I feel.
So this is Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, the seminal coming of ager from Judy Blume. Did you read this book when you were growing up, Emily?
I have to be honest, but I've never even heard of Judy Blume. That's bad, right?
Yes, it is.
That's really bad.
I don't know how you got through your teenage years without reading about...
Two words, Jacqueline Wilson's how I got through my teenage years. But I feel maybe Jacqueline Wilson's, like, for my generation in England, like our version of Judy Blume. In a way.
Maybe. Yeah.
But yeah, so I'd never heard of Judy Blume. The only reason I was excited for this film was because it's from the director of Edge of 17, which is one of my favourite coming of age movies. I absolutely adore that. Kelly Freeman Craig. But I hadn't read the book. I want to read the book now. It's going on my Christmas wish list for sure.
It's quite interesting then that you haven't read the book, so you haven't come at this with any sort of preconceived ideas about it. For anyone who hasn't read the book, it is the story of Margaret, a New York teenager who is just about to change, just about to come into adulthood, when her parents move her from the city to New Jersey, to the suburbs, and she meets a whole load of new school friends and classmates, and that the whole horror of adolescence begins. Periods, boys, what to wear, spin the bottle, the whole thing. And offsetting that is the experience of her mother, played by Rachel McAdams, who is trying to guide her through that, but is also suffering with some parental issues of her own. Did you like it? Did it
speak to you? I love this. It's amazing. I hope you feel the same. Loved it. I was like sobbing at the end. I think I said earlier, I do cry a lot at movies. But do you know what really shocked me is that it sort of reminded me how, even if this is set in the 1970s, nothing's really changed for women in terms of growing up. And it was so relatable. And one thing I found refreshing about it is that I feel like a lot of coming of age movies, there's like, they're always extremes. Like, it's either a kid being bullied or, you know, a kid with severe anxiety. Think about like eighth grade or something, or there's a huge party like with Booksmart, whereas this is just simply just a girl growing up. Like, it's so low key, it's so subtle, there's no melodrama. It just felt, I want to say normal, but I mean that in such a, in a good way, but it just simply depicts how it is.
Yes.
And I found that really refreshing, and it's so beautifully done. And Rachel McAdams, if she wants to adopt me, I'm volunteering. Oh,
I know. Such a lovely mum. It really does. And I think, you know, you don't have to be a woman or a girl to relate to this, because this is about the anxieties of teenage years, whether you're a boy or not. You know, there's plenty of boys in this who are negotiating their own path as well. But we can all relate to awkwardness, our parents being so embarrassing, or having to go into a shop to buy something. And in this case, it's sanitary pads. But, you know, boys can be doing that as well with things that are awkward and embarrassing. The person at the till is not the person you want to be serving you. The idea as well, like, to be cool at school, you should wear no socks. And her mother says to her, but you'll get blisters. And she's like, no. And within, you know, walking 100 yards, her heels are rubbed red raw. And she's like, oh my God, but you've got to just push through it at school, because that is the thing that puts you in the cool crew. I loved all those sort of things. Like, yeah, as you say, it doesn't matter what era. Those things are all true of everyone growing up.
They just never change. And I think just the family politics as well, like, all families are complicated. And I think that's why you said as well, but like, anyone can relate to this. Like, I went with a few of my male friends who all loved this as well, because I was interested in, yeah, seeing what their reactions was, because obviously it is about a young woman. But I think because there's so much exploration of family and school, like, even the school politics, like, there's one girl who everybody sort of picks on, and sort of how those relations work. I just think it's a really interesting exploration of, like, just the schoolroom and the family at home. So it's not all just about periods. I mean, there's a lot of period stuff in there and puberty, but it's just, I think, is it 12, 11? I don't know how old they are, but
yeah,
what is life like when you're that age? And there's a lovely scene of, like, she fancies, you know, the boy who mows their lawn, and then the dad sort of sets him off. And that's just really,
delightful. Yeah.
There's so many lovely.
Benny Safdie is playing the dad in such a gorgeous way, isn't he?
It's like, but it is just a gorgeous movie. I think it's made with so much love and care, and it's so subtle. I think that's why I enjoyed it. It's just a nice time. But I think surprisingly emotional, surprisingly effective. And yeah, just super relatable. Like, at the end, like, I think it was in the credits, I noticed that it was Hans Zimmer doing the score, which I didn't even notice, because obviously his scores are so usually blasting noise at you. But here, like, even he understands that it needs to be toned down, stripped back. And it's just such a beautiful movie. I really hope that people go see it, because I feel like it's a bit, like, under the radar at the moment.
Yeah. 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 And also that it sort of has this sort of cozy association with being like this old book that people used to read, a whole generation of people used to read, and maybe it's something that's a bit stuck in a time warp. But that's the absolute brilliance of her. And you should watch Forever Judy Blume, the documentary, if you want to know more about Judy Blume, because she is an absolute force of nature in terms of driving conversation forward about what we should and shouldn't talk about, and periods being one of them. But I digress. Yeah, you're right. The whole idea of this being nuanced, like, even in production design and costume, it's not screaming at you. It's this era. They have a phone that I had when I was a kid. So I was like, that was my phone. But, you know, apart from that, it's not really sort of in your face. It does feel like you could be watching this at any time. Maybe they just don't have their mobiles out. All the conversations feel really organic and authentic and natural. And the thing I really liked about it as well was this idea that all teenagers desperately want to grow up faster than they can. And they're desperate to get the bra and desperate to move on to the next thing and desperate to, you know, become adults and have adult things and issues. And the adults, as we see in Rachel McAdams' mother, just, like, slow down. Like, there's... you've got so much time of that crap to sort out. Just enjoy this and don't be in such a hurry, because once you get here to adulthood, it's not all that. And actually you discover that you are just a 12-year-old person, but in an adult body. And you know no more than you did when you were 12. You just have more experience. And I think it really captures that idea so, so well.
Yeah, I think when it started looking at Rachel McAdams' story, I was a bit like, oh, why are we doing this? Like, surely the conversation should just be on Margaret. But then I think you're right about the stories. They run so beautifully in parallel next to each other. And it helps that Rachel McAdams is just so good. Like, she's just so effortlessly charming. But yeah, I think the fact that the adults are struggling maybe as much as the kids, but they're both handling it quite differently. But then I like how the kids handle situations as well. Like, there's a disagreement, I'm going to say, between the friendship group. And I think in other movies, you'd have them sort of yelling at each other, a big fight. But here, it's just they sort of have a disagreement and move on, which I think is how it often is in real life. Like, it's just so underplayed. It's such a good movie. Honestly, I loved it.
Yeah, it's delightful. Yeah, I think anyone from any age, any era could really enjoy this and see themselves in it.
I think it really, like, crosses, every generation.
Okay, so if you are every generation, I think I'm going to say it's a four quadrant movie, i.e. any age, any demographic, any gender, any sexuality, yes, any political belief can enjoy this.
Any religious belief
movie.
As well.
Anything, yes.
We didn't even touch on the religion aspect.
Exactly.
But
even though God is in the title, it's not necessarily about that. It's about your own belief system, really, isn't it? And how you take that through your life. So I think everyone can enjoy this. And I would suggest everyone go out and see it. So if you fancy that, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. It's out in cinemas on Friday.
Yeah, right. You can watch it. I was just going to say, you can watch it twice in the time it takes you to watch Bears Afraid.
Yeah.
Because it's 90 minutes.
And it makes sense. And you feel relaxed and happy and wanting to phone your loved ones when you come out.
Yeah.
Not the sort of thing I felt coming out of Bo is Afraid.
No, not at all. The opposite.
Exactly. So it is a double bill, like from a bad mother to a good mother. It could be a nice sort of palate cleanser. Anyway, shall we move on to more family? La Familia.
La Familia.
Any other kind of version of family you want to say? It's this.
The great Dom Toretto. If you never would have gotten behind that wheel, I'd never be the man I am today. And now, I am the man who's going to break your family. Piece by piece.
What's up?
Uncle Jacob?
Your dad sent me. Can't wait to see you get out of this one. Boom.
So this is Fast X. Emily, for people who don't know what Fast X is, or the Fast and the Furious, tell us what this is and where we find the family.
So this is the 10th film in the, I think they call it the Fast Saga now.
They do.
They've got rid of the Furious. It's just the Fast Saga. So Fast X, although I wish they did call it Fast 10, your seatbelts, because that would have been, I just love a pun, so we've been happy with that. But this picks up with the family. You know, they're all relaxed, enjoying their life, they're all back together. However, Cypher, which is Charlize Theron's character from, don't know which one she was introducing, but, you know, she's back basically. She comes knocking on Vin Diesel's door and she has a problem. And she says, you know, the enemy of my enemy is your enemy. They both now have a new enemy, which is Jason Momoa's character called Dante.
Yeah.
And he's got a, you know, fight to pick with both Cypher and Dom. And it's quite a ride from there. I don't want to try and spoil it because
it's preposterous, isn't it? One character at one point says, you know, this team, you know, they defy God and logic, and then they do it again. And that is what this whole saga has always been. And this is dialed up to the nth degree of impossible stunts, ridiculous scenarios, turgid, awful dialogue that Helen Mirren even struggles to make sense of.
She does.
It's 2 hours, 10 minutes long. It's a fraction on the wrong side of a decent running time for this kind of movie. It's packed full of action stars. It's ridiculous, but it's a very good time, I think.
I had a lot of fun watching this. I don't know how you feel about Fast and Furious. Like, I wouldn't exactly say I'm a massive fan. I watched all of them for the first time ahead of a recent film, the 9th one. And I wouldn't say I was like super into it. I think I enjoyed them for what they are. But this one is just fun. And I think that's mostly down to Jason Momoa, who is just
he's the MVP.
Absolutely brilliant.
Absolutely.
His opening scene, after we get like his opening scene as the villain, after we have a massive throwback, and he just sort of stumbles on and he's got a scrunchie in his hair. And I think like he's killed some people and then he like licks the blood off a knife. Like he's just such a sociopath and a psychopath and like completely unhinged. But he's having a great time. And I think because he's having a great time, I also have a great time because it's so much fun. Like he knows what people want from a Fast and Furious villain, which is just pure chaos. And he does it with such flair. I love his hair. He has like little space buns, little scrunchies, and the energy is just infectious.
He really got the memo. He understood entirely the tone.
He did.
Vin Diesel is overdoing his thing, which is this earnest thing, which, again, I have a problem with, you know, do your thing, Vin. But when you see it in contrast to Momoa, you're like, I wonder if you need to pick your energy up a bit, Vin, because this guy is wiping the floor with you. Like, I basically just was the bits in between I was just waiting for when we were going to go back to Dante and what laugh he was going to do, how he was going to walk into a scene, what beautiful clothes he was going to be wearing, what colour nail varnish he'd be putting on, and how he'd be incredibly cruel and wicked to somebody within that scene with a casual cruelty that was just hideous. He reminded me in a lot of ways, and I know this is big talk, but of Heath Ledger and the Joker.
I had it written as well, especially with the scene with the knives where he licks the blood off the knives.
Yeah, he is dangerous and incredibly charismatic and, yeah, and a scene stealer.
Yeah, I want to hang out with this man, which is I feel like I want to, but I also would probably end up getting murdered. It's interesting what you say about Vin, because every time Vin Diesel was on screen, I was bored. That's when it lost it for me. And I've always struggled with Vin Diesel's performance in these movies, because I think, especially since I only watched him for the first time for the ninth movie, so I've not had that journey over the years. I've always struggled because it is always too earnest, especially since I knew Fast and Furious has been like this bonkers franchise. And I was like, why is he playing this character like this? But here, like, I think he particularly struggled because he is up against this insane performance from Jason Momoa. I mean, I think everyone else does get the memo to have fun with it. Like Brie Larson, she's having a good time as well.
Yeah.
But then you have Dom Toretto, who's just so serious.
It's ever been thus. He has always been extremely po-faced in this. And there's something kind of sweet and almost sort of radical about, in the middle of this macho, gung-ho, literal dick-swinging contest, that Bin is like crying about his dad in a garage and talking about his family with this supreme earnestness and allowing that character to be mega vulnerable. That's kind of admirable in a way. That doesn't mean that it's entertaining to watch, but it is kind of admirable that in the middle of this film they are, you know, still really doubling down on that sort of drama that he brings to it. But yeah, it's very difficult to see Vin when you have the carnival that is Jason Momoa. I mean, and also, you know, there's some queer coding in Jason Momoa's performance, and that again is quite nice to see in this film. And he's gender fluidy in the things he's interested in. He loves a raspberry car or a purple car. He loves a ballet. He likes to match his nails, and he likes his carpets and his drapes to match. Yeah, he's just completely a ball of energy and entertaining, and I love that. Let's talk about the stunts, though. I mean, bewildering, some of them, and obviously logically absolutely couldn't happen.
Yeah.
Are they thrilling? Do they work?
I think the action in this isn't as good as what we've seen before, to be honest. I love the scene in Rome, the action set piece in Rome with the bomb, I think is fantastic. I think some of the CGI feels a bit cheap there, but you just roll with it. It's a Fast and Furious movie.
Roll with it, see what you've done there. Rolling bomb.
Not even on purpose. I want to talk to you about the ending in terms of stunts, because
No spoilers.
No, but I feel that the last action set piece was lackluster compared to previous ones we've seen in the movies, but even compared to the Rome scene, I just felt at the end a bit disappointed with the concluding action scene, which should be the biggest one, right?
But, you know, this is a part one of a film that will follow, so it has to sort of leave you at a sort of cliffhanger wanting more. Perhaps it did what it was intended.
I felt it was just... the action just wasn't as good as one we've seen before. And I feel it was maybe too much. I say not too much of a cliffhanger, too abrupt, the ending. I was kind of shocked when it cut to credits. I was like, okay, right, this film's over. And they're now saying there might be a three-part finale, aren't they? Because Vin Diesel might have accidentally leaked that on the red carpet.
Yeah, I mean, let's just say there are cameos in this that are going to thrill fans of the franchise.
The post-credit scene, stick around for that.
And also in the middle of the film, there's somebody that pops up quite literally that you think, oh, well, now these guys might be involved. There's more to do and say and more fun to have. I mean, please make sure that in however many films we get out of this, probably more than he's even saying. And Momoa, continue, please. I don't want to see him killed off. However, as we know, if you get killed in a Fast and Furious film, it doesn't mean you're dead, does it?
Not at all. And I hope the family gets back together. I don't know what you think, but I thought they're too split up.
Well, Paul Walker's still childcaring somewhere, isn't he? He's just, I love the fact that they're like, there's a scene where they're all getting together and Paul Walker's car is parked up outside, but he's just not at the barbecue. What's he doing? Is he mixing the salad? Is he refilling the ice tray inside?
He's just cracking open some more Coronas, you know, maybe.
He's just getting, you know, everything ready for the family. They're literally globally spread in this one, aren't they? So I assume we will see them come back together in the next one.
I think in terms of new cast members, I do want to say shout out to Brie Larson because she's going to be overshadowed by Jason Momoa because Jason Momoa is so good. But I also really, really liked Brie Larson.
And her shoes. Great suits.
And I think she also got the memo of just absolutely just go with it. And I think Alan Richardson as well, who's like the new agency guy, I think he's great. I think my only thing is it's like, I love these new cast members. Is the cast now too big?
Yeah. And then you've got John Cena, we shouldn't forget him, who's consigned to, like, you know, he does a big action entrance and then has this comedy sideline with this little kid that turns into a weird little road movie. How did you feel about that?
I actually really liked that. I think someone somewhere noticed that John Cena is really funny and said, can we have that energy, please, in Fast 10? Because I think in the previous film, he wasn't really... Well, he was a bad guy, wasn't he? See, he wasn't allowed a
like
lot of
everyone,
humor.
They turn.
Like, they all join the family. I do feel it was a bit of a side plot. But personally, because I thought it was really fun and very sweet, and I love John Cena when he gets to be funny, I did enjoy that. But I do see what you mean in terms of... It's just it could have easily been cut for the runtime. Yeah. But a lot
was like, let's
cut.
Give John something to do because he's a big guy physically and as a sort of star. We'll just send him off to do this little bit over here because we can't work out how to crowbar him into this stuff. And then we've got Pete Davidson running an internet cafe in London.
Yeah. Pete Davidson, who I think just cameos in like every movie now, right? Every film needs a Pete Davidson cameo. But I'd like that again. That scene was quite fun. I like it when it's, as I said, the only times I really was bored was when Vin Diesel was on screen. And I feel terrible saying that because he is a star. It's his franchise, but I think it's grown beyond him. But I said, there's just too many characters now. I hope they like rein it in, I think, for the next, whatever X movies they're doing.
They can have some of them having a barbecue whilst the rest of them fight the next thing. Maybe that's the way forward. Paul Walker... can be inside sorting out all of the salads and few people having a barbecue outside and, you know, we'll have fewer people out on the road.
Yeah, one thing I did actually love talking about being on the road about this movie is that we have street racing. I think it's been a while since we've had a street race and there's a great scene where they go to Rio de Janeiro. Another brilliant new cast member, Daniela Michaud. She's fantastic. I loved her as Ratcatcher in The Suicide Squad. So great to see her on screen. And I felt like that was quite a nice nod to sort of where it all began.
Yeah.
Because I think it's been a while. Not every Fast movie has the street racing scene, but they are just very, not. I don't want to say gritty, but sort of more grounded compared to the big helicopter explosions. And I really liked that scene. So I'm glad that they had the sort of nod to the earlier roots of the franchise.
Yeah. And let's talk about Jason Statham. There's a very odd joke in this. I didn't know what it was trying to suggest about his character. No spoilers, but it involves a punch bag. And I didn't really understand where that was going. Is he a sadist?
I don't know. But I like the Stath. I like it when he pops up. I think this is a really controversial opinion, but my favourite Fast movie is Hobbs and Shaw. That is controversial, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, it is a Fast movie, but it's kind of not, isn't it?
I know. It's a spin-off. I think because I just really love the character of Deckard Shaw. I think he's just really fun. So I was very happy when he popped up. But I think you're right. I think some of the dialogue's just terrible in a lot of it. But sometimes so bad it's good. Like the scene where they're talking about defying gravity, defying logic, defying God, which is so self-referential. Like they're cracking into what Fast has become. It feels badly written, but it feels so self-aware that I was like, right, this is really funny. And I got a lot of laughs at my screening. What was the media like? Because my screening was just like 10 of us.
It was there was the gold Lamborghini parked outside for
Did you get a ride in that, Jane?
Sadly not. I did try. But yeah, it was full of people who are huge fans of the franchise. And they were whistling, whooping, cheering. Every time something preposterous happened, they were like, That's what we want. We want a car backing out of a loading bay of a plane onto a motorway. That's what we want from this. So yeah, I think if you're a fan of the franchise, it's totally going to hit all the right notes for you.
Yeah, and it does sound like it is something you need to see on the big screen. I was lucky to go to the BFI IMAX, so really the biggest screen, and it looked amazing. And the sound, the surround sound, so it is definitely a big screen. Go with your friends, have a Corona. That's what Vin would want you to have. What the family would want you to have.
Oh yes, there's many bottles of that on display there, just in case you weren't certain which brand of beer they preferred. It is very much hammered home. And then at one point, Brie walks into a bar and she says, a Belgian, and gives a no brand beer. And it's like, oh, no.
Yeah. I don't think they even drink that one. It's just left on the table.
No, we're not drinking that. It's the one that we've got a partnership with. It's this one. So yeah, I would say go to the cinema, get your beer in, enjoy it. It's dumb as anything, but that's just how you want it, isn't it?
It's exactly what you need from a Fast and Furious movie.
Okay, so if you fancy that, it is out in cinemas on Friday. So, film of the week then, Emily, if you're suggesting one of these, which one would you be sending your mates to on Friday?
Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. For sure. Yeah. For sure.
Yeah, I do love that one. But I think I'm actually going to say Fast X, just for the fact that this is bombastic, massive cinema, and I don't think anyone should miss Jason Momoa. And I think having seen what he did, he was so magnetic in Dune as well, and that huge cast, and managed to sort of really leave an impression there, even though he disappeared quite quickly within that film. And seeing him in this, I'm like, now I'm a little bit more excited about Aquaman 2. And also, what can you cast him in that really challenges him outside of a sort of DC sort of superhero mold? What might he be capable of? Can I see it? I want to know. And I think Momoa might just do something that will surprise us all. So go see this, because I think this is where people will say, Jason Momoa, he's not just a weird beefcake. he actually has something extra, and let's see where he goes with it. Right. A reminder then, if you like this podcast, you can make your life easier by subscribing to it. Just press that button now and you're all set. And to say it's the last week of our issue being on sale, which has Indiana Jones on the cover. If you haven't got it, go out and buy it, because Indiana Jones has now premiered at Cannes and we all need to see it. And if you want to know everything about it, it's all in the pages of our magazine. That is all we have time for now. We are back next week. But in the meantime, we have a listener's question. This is from Sachin Kishnan. Emily, what's the film that didn't get a sequel that you wish had one?
This is such a good question. I was like really thinking hard of this. I've actually gone for Live, Die, Repeat, the Tom Cruise, Emily Blunt action film. And I think elsewhere it's called Edge of Tomorrow. I think it has two different titles. I feel like there's been talk of a sequel since it came out. I know it had a title at one point, which was Live, Die, Repeat and Repeat. Not too convinced by that title. I think they could have made it a bit more snappy. I think I just went into that film with very low expectations and was shocked by how good it was. Emily Blunt, fantastic as an action hero. There's definitely potential there in terms of future storylines and things that could happen. I know it's maybe trying to make it work, but Tom Cruise is the world's busiest man. I just really need it to happen.
Okay, cool. I would like to see, and again, this is one that's been talked about, but I'm not sure it will ever happen due to the personal circumstances of some of the cast members, Call Me By Your Name 2. The book came out and it does have a closure for people who are fans of Elio and Oliver. I would like to see it happen, but I'm not sure it can in its current form. But I would like to see Chalamet essay that character as an older boy. Not even a boy, an older man, and where he's got to with that. And then I've always sort of fancied, knowing what happened to Captain Von Trapp and Maria when they got over the mountain and real life took hold. And I'd love like a gritty Sound of Music, like when you're out of Austria and you're living and it's the war and you've got like those millions of annoying brats to look after.
Yeah. So many brats.
How does that romance live? I feel like a gritty sort of heartburn styly drama about Maria and Captain Von Trapp and how they keep their love alive. I'd like it to be a bit more saucy than obviously the musical is as well. I'm looking for a raunchy sort of kitchen sink drama on the Von Trapps.
I'd watch that.
Okay, there we go. There's an idea, Hollywood. You can have that one for free. Okay, so on that note, I think we should probably say goodbye. We'll be back next week with more. But for now, say goodbye, Emily.
Goodbye.
Oh, that was very... That was dulcet, wasn't it?
I was trying to make it sound a music style for you.
Oh, okay. Lovely. Goodbye. Good night. Farewell. Au revoir.
Yeah,
adieu.
Yeah.
Adieu. Adieu. To you. And you, which always annoyed me because it's like, adieu and you are not the same thing. But there we go.
No.
On that note, we will say goodbye. Bye.
Bye-bye.